You probably realize by now that we're unlikely to finish Colossians, and I apologize for that. I would like to finish it. Last time I did it took, I think it was 45 hours if I remember correctly, so we probably won't get all that in today, but I trust that what has been communicated is of help. We're still in really the opening section, Paul's prayer from verse 9 through to verse 14. And he's praying for the growth of these Christians. And you remember the tree, it has the root system, that is that you might be filled with all the fullness of God. And it leads on to a lifestyle which is living a life that is worthy of the one who has called you and pleasing him in every way. And the only way you can please him is if it's actually Jesus Christ who is living in you and through you, because nothing else is acceptable. And then there is these four branches. And the first one is bearing fruit in every good work, that everything you do might actually be fruitful and positive in terms of the kingdom and in terms of eternity. That you would be growing in the knowledge of God, being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, and that you might have great endurance and patience. And then the fourth branch, giving thanks to the Father joyfully, who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in the kingdom of light, for he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. And you know, normally it ought to take at least one lecture each for each of the four branches, and then two more for the concluding ideas. Obviously we can't do that. What I propose to do is just look at that last verse and then go back and look at the branches for as long as time permits us. So verses 12 and 13, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in the kingdom of light, for he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness. There's a contrast there, obviously, between the kingdom of light and the dominion of darkness, and he's brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. We looked at Job yesterday, and we saw that although Job was not aware of it, just as we are not aware of all these radio programs that are passing through here right now, and all the TV programs that are going right through where your skull is, because we're not on that wavelength. Job was not on the wavelength. They didn't realize that the collapse of his house, the death of his sons, the disappearance of his sheep, the murder of his servants, etc., all had something to do with God and something to do with Satan. And everything that was happening to him in the physical realm had something to do with the spiritual realm, and it was originated in the spiritual realm, but it had its consequences in the physical. And we need to understand that, we need to appreciate that. And so these two main actors in the drama, if you like, God, who is supreme, but the devil, who is also very powerful, but his power is always only a permitted power insofar as God allows him. And that in itself is a great mystery. It's called a mystery of iniquity. We know that the day will come when the devil will not have any power at all. But why God allows him power now is something of a mystery. I know some of the answer to it. I'm not sure I know all the answer. But when you think about that, you need to think about it in terms of your own life. Everything that happens to you has something to do with God and something to do with Satan. It's not just accident, it's not just chance. It's not that kind of a world. Everything that happens to you has something to do with God, something to do with Satan. Now, God, of course, has a home, and his home is called heaven. And Satan, he also has a place, and it's called various things like the pit, but one of them is hell. And heaven is, as we've already seen, a kingdom. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. Now, hell is not a kingdom, really. Hell is an empire. See, you've heard of the empire that strikes back, haven't you? Well, this is the one that tries to. So you've got the kingdom of heaven and the empire of hell. But also you've got the place called heaven and the place called hell. And every one of us is going someday either to the place called heaven or to the place called hell. How do we know that? Well, how many people do you know who are running around fit, healthy and active here on earth and are 200 years old? Not very many, probably. So we're all going somewhere. And if you'd like to know for sure which place you're going to, it's very simple. You know, you don't need to be in any doubt at all. If you want to know which place you're going to be, you can make absolutely certain. And you will be certain before the end of this class, whether you want to be or whether you don't. But if heaven is a kingdom, how does a king operate? As far as I understand it, you can't have a kingdom without a king, can you? So if a kingdom has a king, what does a king do? He rules, okay? If the king rules, what does everyone else do? They do as they're told. They obey. That is how heaven is. You may not like that idea, because not many people like the idea of being in submission. But heaven is a kingdom with a king who rules and everybody else does what they're told. That's why we pray, "Thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven." And the thing that actually makes heaven heaven is that God's will is actually done there. Not just talked about or ignored, but actually done. Now, if you don't like the idea of doing everything that somebody else says and being in submission to them without qualification, and not many people do like that, and being committed to obey even before you know what the instructions are, which is also part of the deal. It's not you tell me what I'm supposed to do and then I'll think about it. And if I like it or if I agree with it, I'll do it. It is I'm committed to doing what you tell me to do because you're king. And whatever you say, I'm already committed to doing, whether I understand it or not, whether I like it or not. That's called obedience. And if your attitude is you tell me what you like and then I'll sit down and think about it and I'll decide whether I'll do it or not, forget it. That's not obedience. That's just pleasing yourself. But if... let me just illustrate that a little bit. I think I told you that one of my children, actually my oldest son, was born in Bolivia. And he was 18 months old when we brought him back to Britain. And lots of things that he'd never seen in Bolivia that he saw for the first time, actually in his grandfather's house in Northern Ireland. And there we were, Northern Ireland, our first breakfast, and we were having cornflakes, and he'd never seen cornflakes before. And he was sitting up in his high chair, this bowl of yellow objects in front of him, and he looked at them very suspiciously as though to say, "Do you really expect me to eat those?" And then he saw that the rest of us were eating them, so he decided he might as well try them because there wasn't anything else. So he sort of took a spoonful, and as I say, he was about 18 months old at this time. Took a spoonful and stuck it in his mouth. Didn't immediately chew it, but just sort of held it in his mouth and felt them and savored the taste. Finally swallowed it, and thought a bit, wasn't too bad, let's try another one. So he had a second spoonful. Then he decided, "Hey, these are not bad." And the little spoon began to go like a windmill, faster and faster, and a stream of cornflakes in the general direction of his mouth, dribble of milk down the chin, and a big happy smile on his face, and he demolished the whole plate. And when it finished, he reached out with his spoon and hit me on the shoulder and said, "More!" He's 20 now, and his manners have deteriorated since then. But I filled up his dish for a second time, and he attacked the second bowl with great enthusiasm, began to slow down by the end because he was getting very full, but finally managed to put the last spoonful in. And there was a sort of vague grin on his face and a glazed expression in his eyes, and little stomach was hanging out over the table of his high chair, and he finally flaked out. I looked across at my wife, full of gooey parental sentimentality, and I said to her, "You know, I think if I only had a few pennies left in the world, I'd give them to Paul, or I'd spend them on cornflakes to give them to Paul just to watch him enjoy them." And that was quite a genuine sentiment. That's the way I felt. A few minutes later, he'd recovered, and he'd gone upstairs to this whole new world known as the bathroom. And he'd never seen a real bathroom before, because there are not too many in the jungles of Bolivia. And he had gone there, and he had closed the lid on the toilet, and he climbed on top of the toilet, and from there into the wash basin. He was sitting on the edge of the wash basin with his feet in the plug hole. He got hold of grandfather's instant shaving cream, and he had sprayed it round his face and done quite a good job, and he was just picking up grandfather's cutthroat razor with 6 inches of nice bright surgical steel when his rotten father came into the bathroom. And I took in this scene fairly quickly, and the first thing I did was to grab the wrist of the hand that held the razor. Next thing I did was to remove the razor, put it down. I then lifted him down out of the wash basin before he fell backwards onto his head, probably broke his neck. And then I made a rule: thou shalt not play with cutthroat razors. Paul registered his deep appreciation by lying on the floor, banging his head on the floor, banging his heels on the floor, banging his fists on the floor, and screaming till he passed out. Takes after his mother. And if he could have put it any more clearly, he would have said this: "Who gave you the right to interfere in my life? I resent your interference. Who are you to make laws for me?" Now, why did I? 2 reasons. One, I actually knew a little bit more than he did. He knew that grandfather used that thing. He'd watched him that morning. He knew that it looked pretty. But I also knew that it was sharp. And that he could end up with no fingers or other severe deficiencies like no ears. In which case, you'd be blind if you needed to wear glasses. So, because I knew more than he did, I was prepared to interfere. But there's another reason too, and that is that I actually loved him. See, if I didn't love him, and I loved him then just as much as I did when he was eating his cornflakes, if I didn't love him, why be unpopular? You know, I knew he wasn't going to enjoy it. I could predict exactly what he would do. He did it several times, quite impressive. But I actually loved him enough to be unpopular if necessary. But I was going to make the rule anyway. And God's laws and God's instructions are always based on 2 things, total knowledge and total love. And when you know that, it's not all that difficult to submit. So heaven is a kingdom with a king who rules. Everybody else does what they're told to do. Now, what we need to determine now is how hell operates. See, because hell is not a kingdom, it's an empire. But how does this empire operate? See, and I'm going to ask Audrey just to come up here and help me, because I need the right person to come on, Audrey. Nice and colourful today. What Audrey and I are going to show you is how the devil does not organise the empire of hell. See, now you just stand in front of there. Aren't they an inspiring crowd, Audrey? Aren't they? Let me tell you, this is better than average.
Better than what?
Better than normal. It must be because it's the first lecture I've had before. Anyway, this is how the devil does not organize the empire of hell.
Ah! Audrey! Audrey, you are my slave. You are going to do everything that I command you. Thank you. Sit down.
That is how the devil does not organize the empire of hell. He does not tell you, you're my slave, you're going to do everything I tell you. This is the principle on which hell operates. Very simple. Please yourself. That's all. Please yourself. All you've got to do. Like this. Do you feel like saying that? Do you want to say that? Well, then say it. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. If you want to say it, that's all you got to do. Say it. It doesn't matter if somebody else will be hurt by your saying it or misguided. It doesn't matter if it will cause a divorce or a civil war. If you want to say that, then you go ahead and say it. Because all you've got to do is please yourself. Do you want to have that? Well, then take it. If you want it, there's only one consideration, isn't there? If you want it, you ought to have it. You please yourself. It doesn't matter who it belongs to. It doesn't matter who else wants it or who else needs it. If you want it, you take it, because your only consideration is please yourself. Do you want to do that? Well, go ahead and do it. It doesn't matter what happens afterwards. It doesn't matter if the girl gets pregnant. It doesn't matter if somebody else is embarrassed or somebody else is hurt or the name of Jesus Christ is dishonored. If you feel like doing it, then you do it, because all you've got to do is please yourself. Yeah? But you weren't created to please yourself, you were created to please him. But that's how the devil organizes the empire of hell, please yourself. On the other hand, the kingdom is, the king rules and we do as we're told. Now, every one of us is going either to the place called heaven or to the place called hell, right? And if you want to know which one you're going to, it's very, very simple. You're going to the place that corresponds to the organization you are already in. Which organization are you already in? Well, it's really easy. Either he is your king and you're doing as you're told, or he's not and you're pleasing yourself. And when you know fundamentally which way you live, then you know which outfit you're in. Right? And when you know which outfit you're in, then that's the place you're going to. Nothing difficult about it. It's very simple. It's very clear. It's true. Suppose this morning I was suddenly to discover, hey, I'm on the wrong side. And I would like to get out of the empire of darkness and cross over to the kingdom of heaven. How would I do that? Well, I might go and I might talk to God and I say, excuse me, God, I would like to join the kingdom today. And he says, yes, I suppose you would. But why should I let you in? Why should he let me? This is me, Ken Needham. He said, yeah. Seems like a good reason to keep you out. Well, yes, you have got a point. Well, I tell you what, I will do everything that you tell me to do for the rest of my life. How's that? Well, of course you will, because this is a kingdom and that's where a kingdom operates. That doesn't get you in, but that's the way people behave when they are in. Oh. I'll tell everyone how great you are. Well, thank you. I am the king of the universe. Yeah. And I don't see that that's anything to go around apologizing for. I'll give you all my money. Well, thank you. I do own the universe. Yeah, and your money. Yes. So why should I let you in? Why not? What have you been doing? Me? Nothing. Nothing? Nothing. That's terrible. You're supposed to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself, and you've been doing nothing? Nothing. You haven't been doing nothing anyway. Come on, what have you been doing? I tell you, nothing. Never murdered my granny. At least, only once. So what have you been doing? Nothing. Been pleasing yourself? Yeah. Something wrong with that? If you've been pleasing yourself, you've been serving my enemy. This is my universe and you're eating my food and breathing my air. And everything you've got I've given to you. And you're serving my enemy, that means you're a traitor. Do we admire traitors? You understand the word traitor, don't you? Do we admire them? You know, is it such a great qualification for national appreciation? You're a traitor. How long have you been a traitor? Ten years? Do you know what they used to do with traitors in England in the old days? If the ordinary people could get hold of them, they used to put a rope round their neck and string them up from the highest, from the nearest tree. And hanging like that, they did a little dance and then they stopped dancing. When they stopped dancing, they cut them down again and they cut them in two that way and then they cut them in two that way and then they burned them. It was bad for their health. And the authorities didn't like the ordinary people doing that because there was supposed to be some sort of organization in the country. So they didn't like it when traitors fell into the hands of the ordinary people. So they would do everything they could to protect the traitor. And rather than take him by stagecoach down a road which could be hijacked, very often they would bring them down the middle of the River Thames in a little boat. The River Thames flows into the city of London where there is a tower. The people of London have a fabulous imagination. So do you know what they call their tower? Tower of London. And the River Thames flows right by the walls of the Tower of London and the walls go right down into the river. And this little boat would come there, and Tower of London, by the way, is a castle, and it would tie up to the wall of the castle, and there's a gate that opens just above the level of the river and opens into the castle and it opens out over the river, and the traitor will be taken from the boat through the gate and into the castle, and the gate is known as Traitor's Gate. When they got the traitor inside the castle, they would make him comfortable with his neck on a big stone block. And a man dressed like Batman with a big bag over his hat and eye slits would come along. And with an axe, he would separate the head from the rest. Now, how many times do you suppose you had to be a traitor in order to get your head cut off? Once, right? Just once. And God says, you've been a traitor for 10 years? You've been pleasing yourself for 10 years. Every day of your life, you've pleased yourself for 10 years. That's 3,650 days. So why should I let you into my kingdom? And I have to come around to admitting there is absolutely no reason why I should. No reason why I should. What I deserve is to be punished as a traitor, because that's what I am. But when I get to that point, there he shows me, nailed to the cross, the king. And that the king died for the traitor to get the traitor out of the empire of hell and to pay his entrance fee into the kingdom of heaven. And that is the only way anybody ever gets in. Because Jesus Christ paid for you. So says verse 13, he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness, and there is no way that you or I could have got out of there. And brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Redemption is not the same as the forgiveness of sins, you realize. What is redemption? Suppose that the new director of His Hill, Mr. Bill Bushhouse, realized that he doesn't get the enormous respect and support and appreciation that a man of his distinguished position and abilities and characteristics deserves and would rather like to have from you lot. So he thinks about it, and he thinks, somehow or other, I have to impress these people with my true importance. And having thought about it, he realizes that what he has to have is a status symbol. Status, if you must. He needs a status symbol. Having thought about that, he decides that the obvious one is a car. And if he just had the right kind of car, then that would impress you. And having thought about it, he decides that there is really only one model that's going to be good enough, and that is a Rolls Royce. See? And a sort of convertible yellow Rolls Royce. And so he investigates from the Rolls company to find out how much a Rolls Royce costs, and he discovers it's on average about $200,000. And so he checks up with a bank account to see whether he has $200,000 in the bank at the moment, and he doesn't, so he saves his Hill salary for a couple of months, and then he orders one. And when you order a Rolls Royce, you don't have to go and fetch it, they deliver it for you. So a Rolls Royce is delivered to Bushman's house, Bushhouse's house. actually on a Saturday evening, and being a deeply spiritual man, he decides he's not going to go joyriding on Saturday night. He will reserve this vehicle for its proper use, and that is to come to worship with it on Sunday morning. And it so happens that the whole school is on outreach to the Burnie Bible Church, so he decides that the thing to do is just to leave things a little bit late and turn up at the Burnie Bible Church just a minute or two late so that you'll all be there to see his distinguished arrival in this yellow convertible Rolls Royce. So he leaves things a little bit later than usual, and then he goes out of his house and he discovers that the Rolls is not there because Mrs. Bushhouse has come to church in it. Women have rights in America after all. And so she has just taken the car and she's arrived here. Being a very humble man, he naturally forgives her, and he is very fit, so he sets his wheelchair bowling down the hill and into Burnie, and he arrives there just a few minutes later than he really wanted to be. And he's rather hot and sticky and comes into church in his wheelchair, and naturally forgives his wife. He does lock her up in the church office to make sure she doesn't do it again. And he thinks, well, at the end of the meeting I can go home in my Rolls Royce, and that will be just as good really as coming to church in it. So he tries to keep his mind on important things while he's in the meeting, but as soon as it's over he goes outside to go home in his Rolls Royce, but he can't but it's not there, because Gwenda has come home with it. Gwenda has always wanted to drive a Rolls Royce. And she comes back to the hill in it, so Bill pushes himself back up the hill in his wheelchair. And Sunday night, Charlie McCall's out in it. And every day somebody else uses it. And 2 years go by and everyone has driven it except for Bill. And while he is an extremely patient, forgiving kind of person, after 2 years it's just beginning to really irritate him. And he sits down one day and he thinks, now how much did I pay for that Rolls Royce? $200,000. If I paid $200,000 for it, does that not mean it's mine? And if it's mine, why are all these other people riding around in it? He said, this is an awfully stupid story, and I know it is. Except, didn't somebody pay more than that for you? Didn't they? Isn't it true that Jesus Christ paid more than that for you? And if he paid more than that for you, does that not mean then that you belong to him? If he bought you? Doesn't it mean that? And is it possible, do you think, that Jesus wanted to use you one day for something? And he came along wanting to use you, but he couldn't use you because you were off doing something for somebody else or something for yourself or any old dumb thing except be there for the one to whom you actually belong. And when you think about it, it could be 2 years or it could be 10 years or it could be as long as you've lived. And he's never really been able to use you because you've never really acknowledged that you actually belong to him. See, lots of people don't. The Corinthians didn't. That's why Paul wrote to them and he said, hey, don't you know you have been bought with a price and you are not your own? So glorify God in your spirit and in your body because they are God's. They belong to him. And you actually belong to God twice. Once, because he made you. Twice, now, because he bought you. And he bought you with the precious blood of Jesus Christ. And that is what the word redeemed means. It means you've been bought. It means you've been bought out of slavery and into the glorious liberty of the children of God. Out of the empire of darkness and into the kingdom of light. So he says in verse 13, he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. You may well have turned over a rock in the summer, perhaps in your yard back home. And when you turn it over, underneath it are all kinds of slimy things that don't like the light. They like to hide in the dark. They come out at night and they hide under the rocks during the day. And men love darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil. And when you live on those conditions, you don't really examine your thoughts and examine your motives and examine your habits in the light because it's uncomfortable. And they won't stand examination. You much prefer not to examine them and hide in the darkness. And when you're pleasing yourself, that's the way you have to do all the time because it's too painful to really test your behavior. But he has delivered us from all that and brought us out into the kingdom of light that we might be children of light and that we might walk in the light and that we might be open and happily open for him to examine our motives and our behavior because we want to please him. And he is enabling us to please him. We don't have to hide in the darkness anymore. And we don't care who knows what we do or why we do it because it's right. So he has brought us into the kingdom of light.
That is why, verse 12, we're giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in the kingdom of life. And giving thanks is a necessary part of the Christian life. Ephesians 5:19, don't ever be drunk with wine, but do be being filled by the Spirit, giving thanks for all things to God the Father. Giving thanks for all things. How can you give thanks for all things? That's unreasonable, isn't it? Well, not really. Not if you know something. And it's always good to know something. I get concerned when I come to this country or to Canada. I get concerned when I listen to you talking. Not so much because of what you do to what used to be my language, but when I think about what you say. See, I will not have been on American soil 5 minutes before I hear somebody say this, I guess. You ever hear anybody say that? I guess. If it's not that one, that's this one, I suppose. And if it's not that one, then they come from Georgia or Alabama and it's I reckon. And every American I meet is either guessing, supposing, or reckoning. And I get on an aircraft and I see the pilot and I say to him, excuse me, is this the flight from Nashville? I guess. Well, you know, I would prefer to go to Nashville rather than New York or Timbuktu or something. Can you give me something a little bit more definite than that? You know, if you're the pilot, I would really like to know that you're sure. But pilots are guessing about their destination. Surgeons are supposing that this is the correct organ to take out when they're operating on you. And everybody is either guessing, supposing, or reckoning. Well, it's okay, I suppose. But sometimes it's good to know something, isn't it? And to be definite. Here's something you can be definite about. We know. We don't guess, suppose, or reckon. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God. Romans 8:28. Good, you remember, is not necessarily comfortable. Good is becoming like Christ. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God, who are called according to His purpose, which is that we might be conformed to the image of His Son. And if you know that all things work together for good, how many things then do not work for good? Well, you're allowed to grumble about all those. Mm-hmm. Everything that doesn't work for good, you can grumble about. But all things work together for good, and those things you can't grumble about. In fact, if you know that they work for good, then what you say essentially is, thank you. Very briefly, just for a minute, turn to John chapter 17. And you'll see Jesus referring to some gifts from the Father. This is the prayer that he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane at the end of his life. Verse 4, I have brought you glory on earth by completing the work you gave me to do. Okay. The work you gave me to do. Verse 6, I have revealed you to those whom you gave me out of the world, the men you gave me. Verse 8, for I gave them the words you gave me. The words you gave me to say. Verse 7, they know that everything you have given me comes from you. The things that you gave me. Verse 22, I have given them the glory that you gave me. So this is how Jesus refers to his work.
his life rather, the work you gave me, the men you gave me, the things you gave me, the words you gave me, and the glory that you gave me. A whole series of gifts from the Father. When you think about the work that Jesus had to do, most of it was carpentry. And it wasn't beautiful, exotic carpentry, and it was before the days of power tools. He personally built Niagara Falls and made available all the hydroelectricity, all the oil, all the nuclear energy in the universe, but he cut wood in the sweat of his face. Carpentry. The men you gave me, Judas. Would you have been happy if Judas was your disciple? Which of the original 12 disciples would you have chosen if you had to use any 12 people from the whole world to change the rest of the world? And you could choose anybody you like. Would you have chosen any of those original 12? It would be very easy for Jesus to say, "Hey, Father, you know, I'm just fed up to the back teeth of this stupid carpentry shop. And these arrogant Romans that think they own the place and don't want to pay for the things that I make or repair for them. And these Jews that argue over every shekel that I try to charge them. And I left heaven to come to earth to win the world, not to do carpentry. And here I am, 28 years old, never preached a sermon, never performed a miracle, nobody knows who I am. What am I here for? And why have I got to live in Nazareth? Sure, I made Hawaii. And here I am in this dump." It's not how you find him, though, is it? Or you might find him like this. "Hey, what about these disciples? Do I really have to live with Jesus? That guy's going to betray me. And these fishermen, have you ever lived very close to a fisherman on a hot day? They really stink. I spent 3 years trying to teach them two things. So simple. Number one, I'll die. Number two, I'll rise again. Nobody's understood anything in 3 years. And when I've gone, they're going to change the world? Is it unreasonable of me to want one disciple of average intelligence? But you don't find him like that. He didn't complain about the people God put in his life. He didn't complain about the work God gave him to do. Because when somebody gives you something, you say, "Thank you." Always giving thanks to the Father for all things. Why? Because all things work together for good to those who love God. And it was no mistake that Judas was a disciple. And it was no mistake that Peter, James and John and the others were chosen. The Father hadn't made a mistake, it just looked like it. And it wasn't an error that he lived in Nazareth and that he had to do carpenters at the age of 30. It was all part of the Father's plan. Difficult to understand, maybe. But everything working together for good in the life of Jesus. And Jesus never once complained. "Thank you for the work you gave me to do. Thank you for the men you give me out of the world. Thank you for the words you give me." Okay? Giving thanks to the Father. Why? It is an expression of your trust. When things look as though they're going wrong, when the situation is difficult, uncomfortable, painful, as it often will be, giving thanks. Because you believe that a God who really does love you and actually does have everything under his control is working all things together for good. And you know that. And your fundamental trust has been brought about this. He has rescued you from the dominion of darkness and brought you into the kingdom of light. And you have redemption. He has purchased you at the cost of the lifeblood of his only Son. And that cost goes beyond anything you could ever imagine. Sometime today, Try and imagine all the pain there has ever been and ever will be in the whole of the world. And add it all up. And the cross must be, at the very least, equivalent to that. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. And when you think of the shame of every rotten thing that's ever been done in the history of the world, every man that's ever betrayed his wife, every woman that's ever betrayed her husband, 6 million Jews exterminated during the Second World War, and all those kind of things. And you add up all the shame and all the guilt of those things looked at from the standpoint of God's love and God's righteousness. And you add that on to all the pain that the human race has ever suffered, you're beginning to see a very minute picture of what the cross really meant to the Son and to the Father. And that's the price of your redemption. And when you look at that, and you remember God has done that for you, what are these minor irritations that we experience on the way? Convinced by what is done for us, we always give thanks to the Father. Time to stop. Father, we thank you so much that we have been rescued from the empire of darkness and brought into the kingdom of light. We praise you for that, and we thank you so much for giving Jesus to die for us. And thank you that this morning, every one of us who has accepted salvation from the hand of Jesus, bought for us in his blood, and has repented and has changed over from I please myself to I submit to the King,